listening to Inclusive AF with Jackie Clayton and Katie Van Horn.
Good morning, Jackie.
Oh, good morning, Katie. How are you?
I'm good. Happy Super Bowl Monday.
What do you even call that?
We're done with football for like 7 minutes is what I call it. I did like, there were a bunch of ads during the Super Bowl that were like, don't worry, football's back in like 5 weeks. And I'm like,
my personal favorite ad was the inner trauma I felt by the Jesus ad.
Okay.
That was the one that I was just like, there were all these people yelling at each other's face. And then it was like, Jesus likes all of us. And I was like, okay, there's so many, like, when is the trauma going to stop? And I was like, oh, Jesus. Like, I was like, this is like, so that happened. And Rihanna's pregnant. Blessings.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And we are blessed. And for those of you who are just joining us, this is the Inclusive AF podcast.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes. So I'm sorry, but I do want to say my actual favorite was the flag football.
I loved the flag football,
which I think was women. Nike. That was great. And then like, she goes to like hug her mom in the kitchen and then her mom tries to steal her flags too.
Yes.
That one, I laughed out loud. So that was a good one, but anyhow. All right. This is the Inclusive AF podcast and we have an amazing guest today. And so we're just going to jump right in on this fine Monday morning. I mean, you all will be listening to it on Wednesday, but it is Monday for us. So Aurora, thank you so much for joining us. Would love for you to introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Hi, everyone. My name is Aurora Higgs. My pronouns are she, her, and they, them. I am a lot of things, a mess, chaotic. I am also an activist and an advocate because it's the right thing to do, but also because I am a Black trans non-binary femme in the former capital of the Confederacy here in the Southern United States, Richmond, Virginia. Which means that there's a lot to do in terms of fostering equity and trying to dismantle oppressive systems. And so there are, that's always something I'm trying to do for myself, for people who came before me, people who come after me. And, but I'm also not a martyr, right? I am a burlesque performer. I am an artist. I am, I saw your face, Katie, when I said burlesque performer. I love doing burlesque.
Let's discuss.
I'm also a scholar for LGBTQIA+ things. And I'm going to talk, later this month, I'm talking about how burlesque is a really great way to find liberation if you're as oppressed as, you know, someone like me being Black, trans, being neurodivergent. And then also I have a mural in Richmond, Virginia, and there is going to be an exhibit that I'm going to be speaking at with the artists. I'm going to be on a limited edition beer can.
What?
I live in a brewery town. And so that's the kind of thing we do in Richmond, Virginia. And I absolutely love it. And so thankful for the support of my hometown. So that's a little bit about me.
That's awesome.
I love that. There was a lot of very cool things. And in reading your bio, I think it's very, I mean, like you said, there is a lot of work, to do, but we're lucky that there are people like you and sharing some of your experiences. And I want to come when you get the beer can, we'll come.
You know what? And it's limited edition at the opening of the exhibit only. And so now I've been tasked by so many people to get my hands on as many of those beer cans as possible.
Yes.
So I will try my best.
Let us know when the opening is. If it's this week, we'll be there. We'll be okay. There.
It's the 17th at the Virginia History of Museum and Culture. For those, if this comes out in time, for anyone who's listening and you want to come, it is a ticketed event, but you know, let me know. Maybe there's something we can do. Just saying, but yeah,
we'll make it work. We'll make it work. Okay, so I don't even know where to dive in right now. Okay, so tell us a little bit about kind of your your coming out story. So, you know, when did you kind of realize what, you know, what were the moments that were kind of impactful for you?
Yeah. Good question. It's an interesting story because I had to come out multiple times, as a lot of trans people do. And I came out to my parents. I was socialized as male, assigned male at birth. For anyone who's listening and, you know, kind of confused by what I mean when I say non-binary trans femme, it means that I was assigned male at birth, socialized as male, identified as male for most of my life, and then transitioned and started identifying as a woman. And then at that, after that point, I was felt like, oh, I don't really want to live with the gender role expectations that we put on women. And so, like, I want to be my own kind of entity. And so, but my coming out story started, I was 7 years old and I came out to my parents as gay. And I have really amazing parents. They are so loving and accepting by default. And so I was taking the trash out, and right before I walked out the door, I just yelled upstairs to my dad and I was like, "Hey dad." And he was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "I'm gay." And just like, matter of fact, then I walked out to go take the trash out. And the reason why I did it that way, I think, is because I was in school, you know, I'm seven, you know, I'm in like first or second grade. I don't know children's ages in schools anymore. And I just gained the language for what it means for a boy to be attracted to other boys. And I had little crushes, even though this was like really young, I had little crushes. I loved me some Brad Pitt, growing up in the 90s. I am a millennial, born in 1990. And so that's, it gives a little bit about some of the background of, like, you know, what was going on around that time. And so that also means that I grew up on like the tail end of the AIDS epidemic. And so a lot of that messaging was still there. And so when I found out the word for gay, I'm really lucky that I got a very neutral definition. It was not editorialized. It was just, they were just like, oh, it's like when boys like other boys. And I was like, oh, that pretty much describes me. And so, I yelled it up to my dad because I just found that. And to me, it had no real gravity. It was just like saying, hey, my hair is like black and I have brown eyes. Like, it was just that for me. And so my dad was very much, he was like stunned. They knew though, because I was the most effeminate, flamboyant child ever. And so they had an inkling. But yeah, my dad was like, okay, well, let's wait till your mom gets home. Let's talk to her about that. And then we decided that when I turned 13, I would kind of revisit and see, because they were just like, you just never know how things will kind of pan out with puberty. But if that's the case, fine. And so was still gay at 13. and yeah, so I identified as male, was happy to do so. Somewhere around teenage years, I kind of drank the Kool-Aid of like, oh, like I want to be like as masculine as possible, even if I'm like queer, because we have a lot of politics in the gay community around masculinity and femininity. And it's a lot to unwrap there. But yeah, I did that. And then somewhere around 23, I kind of started becoming a little bit like, oh, I think I want to do drag. And then at 25, I was sort of like, okay, I don't really want to do drag as much. I want to wear the makeup and maybe identify as genderqueer. And then at around 28, my parents, we were in a car one time and my parents said, hey, just curious, you're wearing like makeup and presenting as femme a lot more and you're not really performing. So like, just curious if you're like a trans woman. And I remember turning to them and saying, I think I know if I were trans, y'all. Like, thanks, I appreciate it. But like, and goes to show parents know best, because it was like less than a year after I was identifying as a trans woman and transitioned at 28 medically and publicly. Although I want to iterate that you do not need to transition medically or publicly to identify as trans. If you are trans, and you know it in your body and in your being, you are trans or no other qualification. So I know I felt like an imposter a little bit, but you don't have to. It's that simple. And yeah, I've been living my life publicly and visibly and quite loudly since then.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It is, it's funny in listening to your story because things have changed. I'm so glad that people have gotten stopped trying to live their life so binary. And I remember flash forward, my son, who I call sweet baby TJ, he was 3 years old and he came home and he was like, "Mommy, boys love girls and girls love boys." And I said, "Okay." And he goes, "But mommy, some boys love other boys and some girls love other girls." And I was like, "Oh, really?" And he was like, "Mm-hmm." Like, it wasn't even a word. He didn't need right. to have the word, right? Right. And it was accepting, like,
oh, sweet baby.
Right? I mean, he was born in 2003. Yeah. And even my oldest identifies as a non-binary. And when recently he said, "Y'all are probably non-binary or at least queer." And we're all like, this was nothing that we would ever consider even thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that there have been more safe spaces for people to enjoy. And you do have great parents. So go hug and love on them, as you know, the next time you have the opportunity.
First of all, big props to sweet baby TJ for being so worldly and so wise, so young. And I completely agree. I think, you know, I don't want people to kind of get up in arms about this, but I think that if we didn't have any social politics around gender or sexuality, a lot more of us would identify as someone in between the lines. You know, the Kinsey scale tells us that human sexuality is a spectrum and very few people, it's like kind of like a bell curve, very few people fall on either end of it as a 0 or 7. And so I'm always striving for a world where people have the truest freedom, even not just from society, but from themselves. Sometimes we carry our own kind of self-hate or self kind of doubt. And I'm striving for a world where people don't have to negotiate with society just to feel and present as authentically as they can.
I love that. I think that's something that, you know, we've had a few speakers, and I'm thinking about one of our last conversations with Eli, and, you know, Eli identifies as two-spirited. And so, like, there are so many pieces to this puzzle. And I think that the piece that everyone gets so stuck on is exactly what you're saying. It has to be this or that. It has to be completely black or white, no gray whatsoever. And I think the gray is where people get so I don't even know what, like, they just don't know how to handle that. And it's fascinating because it's like, it's okay. You don't have to know every piece of the puzzle. Like, if people are happy in their skin, that's actually what matters.
Yeah, I think the gray represents uncertainty and the unknown. And I think the human brain can be really afraid of, like, what's not known or what's not charted. But I am the living proof that you can be black and white. I'm literally, I'm ethnically biracial. I identify racially as black. But I mean, duality has always been a part of my life. I've always known that in a world that acts like black is here and white is here and there's no in between, that I've always lived in the in between. And so that's just something I've carried with me ever since I was a kid. And I'm so thankful to my upbringing for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want you to know, as you're going into these different spaces and consulting, what do you see come up more and more that you're having to kind of discuss, or that your clients hire you to come in to discuss? What kind of things, topics seem to be a regular theme?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a speaker, performer, keynote. I do things like that. And I'm also the VP of a consulting company in Seattle. And so nothing I say here is representative of that, you know, the views and ideas of the my full-time work over at Human Inc. But in my community work that I like to do, you know, as Aurora, it is really around creating opportunities for learning, compassion, and empathy is what I strive for. Now, when folks come to me, they just know that they know that they don't know a lot. And that's step one, is understand that you don't know everything and try to understand what it is that you don't understand, or try to understand that you do not understand. And so oftentimes people are just like, hey, we'd just love for you to come in and just talk to us about inclusion. I've done work for Legal Aid Justice Center. I've done work for the my State Department for health professionals, the State Department for Behavior and Development. And folks are just wanting right now, it seems, to have somebody who is not a trauma story, who is willing to teach other people, because as people on the margins, it's not our job necessarily to teach others. And it is my job as somebody who has a degree in an education in leadership studies, and it's something I've opted into. And so this is my life path. I love what I do, both at the consulting firm and doing the work that I do in communities, leading marches. I do a lot of mutual aid through my social media presence, because that is, there's a lot of things we think big ideas and we think like really big scale, but there's so much that you can do in your immediate network. There are people who live next door to you, so that need help. And so you don't necessarily have to ask yourself, what can I do for the person all the way across the world, but rather, what can I do for the person next to me, for the person who it works in my workplace with me? And so I like to do a lot of education around workplace inclusion, a lot of motivational talks for LGBTQIA+ youth. I am really just somebody who lives my life as an open book, which can be really dangerous as a Black trans femme in the South. And it's still just, it's my passion. I couldn't live a closed life even if I wanted to. I'm just not that person. I'm big, bright, and outgoing, and I love education. People don't really know all the time, and that's okay. You don't have to know. Sometimes it's about starting the conversation with people to gain ideas or to solicit ideas from your workplace. And I think right now, because it's Black History Month, a lot of people are really interested in understanding how what Black queer joy looks like in an landscape where the most that we know about Black trans people is trauma, is some of the challenges and barriers facing us. But folks don't realize that there are things that our community does better than most, just like every community's kind of got their specialty. And one of the things that we do really well is caretaking. We family really well. There's a lot of mothering in the community. And we sometimes they're actually call people who are, you know, take care of a lot of people mother. And it's just us creating familial units that actually fit our lives and that are not necessarily the nuclear model. I think right now people are really interested in knowing like what we do well, what does our joy look like, how can we celebrate all that we contribute as a community. And so I'm really excited to do that.
Imagine how fast we could solve the world's biggest problems if more SaaS startups would gain traction sooner. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. This podcast is dedicated to sharing experiences from B2B SaaS CEOs who are going above and beyond to deliver change that is noticed. You will hear their secrets and learn what is required to build a SaaS business that the world starts talking about and keeps talking about, and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so.
Awesome. I want to chat a little bit or ask some questions around, you know, some of the work that you're talking about with like the discrimination. And you said you did some training for like medical providers, because I think that's one that, you know, our listeners, it can be confusing as an HR person or as a leader. How should I handle this? What should we do? What questions should we be asking? That kind of thing. And so would love for you to share a little bit about some of the work that you've done there, and and also some of the facilitation for those medical providers, because I think that's just such a critical piece to the puzzle.
Completely. Yeah, I think that's the thing. So people who are in professional or technical roles, your job is to know your job, and you don't, and even when you don't know aspects about your job, you seek out professional services, you seek out consulting, you seek thought leaders in that area. I mean, for all of you listening who do HR, remember the first time you ever had to run payroll or had to ask, you know, about these really technical nitty-gritty things. You had to go outside of yourself. You couldn't just make that up. And LGBT and inclusion is much the same. You don't have to be ashamed that you don't know. It's just go out and find someone who does and who can help you and support you in doing that. And so some of the things that I've done in the past, say for medical professionals, has been, you know, I talk about bedside manner, about how to even just circumventing your, if you say you work for a system that maybe doesn't allow for pronouns or preferred names that are not legal names, how you can circumvent that. Like, just because your system doesn't mean you as a person cannot acknowledge somebody's real identity. And pronouns are not preferred, they are just pronouns. And so I think for a long time, we were using the phrase preferred pronouns, and that's fine. We were exploring, we were finding ways to get language to catch up with our lived experiences. And I don't begrudge us for being on a path of learning. And so now that we do know, we no longer use the phrasing preferred pronouns. We just say, what are your pronouns? Or you can simply say, how can I best honor you in your identity? Things like that. And so also letting, helping folks highlight maybe where there are policies, conventions, and best practices that are simply passed down to us by convention and maybe arbitrarily created. And so sometimes, like company dress codes, I've done a talk where somebody was like, well, what do? We've got, you know, dress codes for men, dress codes for women. What do we do about non-binary people? And sometimes I have to remind people that, like, your dress code does not have to be gendered at all.
That's right.
There are ways in which you, and the thing is, like, I get it. People are thinking, like, okay, how do we keep adding, like, new identities to this? And the thing about it is, as we move on, humans will continue to nuance identity, like, over and over again. So the idea is not how to capture every new gender and every new nuance that's coming out, but rather degender it so that it's not relevant. Somebody's gender isn't relevant in when you're talking about how you'd like for to show up at work. Simply say, you know, professional attire. There's also racial and cultural implications to attire. And I tell people a lot, the idea of professionalism in the United States is often based in white ideals and in Eurocentric ideas. So when somebody says, okay, we want you to dress in professional attire, somebody might come in from another culture whose idea of professional attire looks very different than what the Western idea is. And we need to make space for that. It's not just about gender. It's about being inclusive AF in every aspect that we can. And so the thing about being queer and having queer as my politic is that the true politics of queerness are also anti-racist. We are anti-ableist. We are, anti-xenophobic. And so sometimes I'm coming in and I'm talking to people about how to treat their, not just how to treat their LGBT folks, but how to treat their folks inclusively as possible, such that even if somebody is LGBT, they're still captured under the umbrella of inclusion. So I've done talks with, I've done a fireside chat with SHRM. So a lot of you HR folks, I'm sure you're familiar with SHRM and the chapter, your local chapter. And just letting people know that it's okay to not know everything and seek out advice. So I'm here for that. There are other people who don't get their flowers who are really good at this. And industry needs us because industry depends on the capital that humans create, and humans will always be nuanced and slightly chaotic and beautifully so. So, you know, sometimes I come in with a narrow scope and I widen that scope intentionally and say, like, it's, you know, if we're just talking about LGBT, that's fine, but we can easily talk about inclusion and scalable inclusion such that as many people feel like they belong as possible, not just these certain groups that you're picking out, because that's also a type of supremacy and bias, is just like picking groups that are top of mind to service when you could really be doing things that are much more sustainable for your entire workforce.
And I'm glad you said that. And I feel like so many people, first, as they're learning these lessons, as you're sharing, need to think about themselves. A lot of people don't accept themselves and have internalized it, which makes it difficult to get those messages. And I'm very appreciative of you of saying, to you for saying, it's okay if you don't know it anything. I know in doing the work, there's people who feel shame, which turns into anger. And it's like, dude, all I said was,
and like,
I use she, her pronouns. That's all I said. Yep. And you just turned it into this big freaking spiral, like this death spiral. And I think there's something that you should unravel there. And I learned, it sounds like you would have learned this in education as well, that as you're learning, we learned in school that somebody tells you when you're successful, right? Like, you do a paper, you get an A, you do this, you get an A. And in real life, the learning comes in those moments when you feel a little, and it's like, congratulations.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. It's like, real learning happens outside of your comfort zone, right? Mm-hmm. And so as a, you know, Black trans consultant, activist, performer, I don't know how to do my taxes. I have to come. It's okay if I have to come to you to know how to do my taxes, which is something that every individual is expected to do. And yet I don't know how to do it. I don't want to know how to do it. So I seek outside help. And it's really just that simple, is whenever we don't know, we can seek support. That's the whole point of building a community and a knowledge base, a diverse knowledge base, is so we can rely on each other. This whole idea, Western idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, rugged individualism, is going to get us in trouble if we don't really take a step and analyze what that means. As technology advances, as we become more digitally connected with other parts of the world, we're also becoming interdependent. Mm-hmm. And we already know this. Like, I mean, even remember in the pandemic when some countries were really deeply in the throes of COVID-19, we were finding shortages in things like lumber, or, you know, I know in special incense from like Vietnam, like things that we had come to enjoy, we found that we did not have access to them because the folks who we depend on, who live on the other side of the world, were not in a good way. And so it is a myth that we are a truly independent, that you can. I also hate the saying, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, because not only is it not really realistic, it is physically impossible. So how are we using that analogy to mean anything when it doesn't?
Right. You can't.
Possible.
You cannot pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
You can't. And so, like, the idea that that is an analogy that is really, like, affecting people's minds, it's like, okay, I get it. I heard that too. And I was absolutely, I am hyper independent because I am trans, and I have, you know, concerns that sometimes I am going to be on the margins of the world. And so there are a lot of ways where I'm like, no, I'm going to do it myself. But that's exhausting. And it is not sustainable when, you know, plumbers out there might think like, well, what does this have to do with me? I know lots of tradespeople. There's actually a really famous handy woman who's trans. Her name is Mercury. And I got to think of her IG. But even plumbers can be gender diverse. Plumbers can be, trans, they can be women, they can be differently abled. And so this work around diversity, equity, inclusion touches everyone. And let me just say, for all of the plumbers out there, again, I don't know how to do plumbing at my house. And so I will ask you, it should be okay for you to ask me about things that you don't inherently know about. So it's mm-hmm. okay. We're all in this together, I promise.
I don't plumb.
I don't.
Yeah. When you just said the accounting one is the one I love because pretend I know how to do accounting at times in my accounts, like, please stop touching numbers.
You're making things harder for me. Right.
But I love that you say that because it's so true, because all of a sudden when you say, oh, I encourage you to read this book to learn more about various culture, then somebody will say, oh, you shamed me. You made me feel bad. No, I did none of those things. And then like, I remember moving, I live in Waco, Texas, and they said, everybody's ringing tater tot casserole. And I cried for hours. And I was like, I don't belong here because I don't know what a tater tot casserole is. And I'm too embarrassed to ask what a tater tot casserole, I still don't. And then I found out what it is. And then I'm like, why is anybody making tater tot casserole? Like it was a whole thing.
Okay, well, we might be on different sides of that issue because when I heard tater tot casserole, I heard tater tots and cheese, and I'm always in for potatoes and cheese together.
Same. This one had like a cream of chicken. So we'll talk about
it. Okay. Maybe I'm not with that then. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of like hot dish in Minnesota. I was like, I don't understand this. Like it makes no sense.
I've heard of hot dish.
But then it was cheese and potatoes. So yeah.
Which Aurora. Is much different than a hot pot. Completely different.
We have a hot pot place here, which in Richmond, we don't have a lot of like, you know, we're getting better about becoming more worldly, but I am dying to try Chinese hot pot.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Yeah. You'll love it. Definitely. let's just talk about food for a while.
Let's do that. I could absolutely talk about food all day.
One of the first episodes that Jackie and I recorded was right before Thanksgiving. And we were like, so what do you make for the holidays? And we did determine that there are some very different things between a white German Irish household and a black household of what you make. And I still won't make potato salad. So, you know, there's that.
And again, I am white German on my mom's side and then black country, like black North Carolina farmland on my dad's side. So absolutely. We used to do two Thanksgivings and they were quite different. Very different. I definitely preferred my black Thanksgiving a little bit more because we just had way more smatterings of like everything. So yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Inclusive.
Okay. So in Virginia, as you are doing this work and as you're, you know, so how do you get a statue or a recognition such as this? Like, how does that happen? How does that come about?
Yeah, so I have a mural in the north side. No, you're fine. I want a statue. Listen, and I'll tell you why, because it sounds like it's purely vain, but there's a reason why this, I have no shame in like being very open and, I don't know. I think that really quickly, the reason why this was so special to me is that for those of you who don't know, Black trans femmes are one of the most violated communities in proportion to our community size. We are a small community, and yet we receive so much violence, disproportionate amounts of violence. And, for a long time, I haven't checked in a while because it's been very depressing, but for the past 5 or 6 years, we've constantly broken records on fatal violence towards Black trans femmes. Now, trans people in general face a lot of violence. And then when you add being Black to that, then you increase your likelihood of violence. And then you add being a femme to that, whether you identify as a woman or the world perceives you as effeminate, it also goes up again. And so I'm 32 years old, and there was a lot of, before the data came out, and it's still not super clear, but for a long time people were spreading the statistic that the average life expectancy in the US for Black trans women is 35. That is apparently that is actually the case for South America, like Brazil in particular. Here, it's not super clear because we don't do a great job of polling and having cross-sectional data that where you can identify yourself as Black and trans. And so data is really hard to come by. And that's another epidemic, is how are we supposed to make change in a world that demands it, that changes data-backed, when we can't even get our hands on data and no one cares enough to include us in data survey. So that said, I've always been really afraid of my 30s because I know that for a lot of people, for those who do receive fatal violence as Black trans femmes, a lot of the times it happens between their 32nd and 36th birthday. And so that's abhorrent. That is not okay. That is, I will not stand for that. And so having a mural or having something that is, could technically be, you know, I mean, look at how long we had those, these Confederate monuments in Richmond, which most, if not all of them, are finally down. And those were around for a really long time. And so
I say, and disproportionate in Richmond, in Virginia as a whole, just like,
yeah, freaking, yeah.
It's like 60% Black in Richmond proper, which I love. And yeah, when you've got and we were considered the Harlem of the South, you know, right. Maggie Walker, first Black bank president, St. Luke Penny Savers. We have so many, Arthur Ashe, we have so many we have so much Black excellence coming out of Richmond, that having these monuments that we value more than, you know, people's feelings, goes to show that these monuments can be institutions that withstand the test of time, for better or for worse. And so me having a mural means that maybe, just maybe, that mural will last longer on this earth than I do. And so that is a form of immortalization to somebody who is hyper-mortalized, if you will. And so it means a lot to me. It really does. And the way I got a mural is, so me and a group of women here in Richmond, Virginia, my older sister, Chelsea Higgs Wise, who does a lot of work in cannabis legalization, which is a hot topic here in Virginia, mm-hmm. Folks like Dr. Jana, who is also a huge in the DEI space and wrote books like Subtle Acts of Exclusion, and then this, many others, and Nico Cathcart, who is an artist. And we were all honored. Well, I'm sorry. We were all asked to come to the bicentennial of women's suffrage movement. So this was in 2020. Women gained the right to vote in 1920 under the 19th Amendment. And so we were celebrating 100 years, and we met in a place where a group of Virginia suffragettes met up to demonstrate, and we were honored as the change makers of you know, this era. And so I, because of my work in the trans community, and a lot of the work of the other women and femmes who were there, you know, we got to hear a lot about each other and build connections, which I always love. And Nico, who is this person that I didn't even talk to a lot before that, reached out to me like about a year after, maybe a few months, and said, hey, I'm doing a mural in this neighborhood in Richmond that is highly gentrified. And I want this mural to represent the city, not the neighborhood. I want it to represent the true legacy. And so I would really love if it is somebody of color. And I really, if I'm going to do this mural, I want it to be authentic, and I want it to be, I want it to be like real. So she's like, I was talking to some people, your name came up and I remembered you. And I was like, oh, I'd love to have, you know, a mural of Aurora. And reached out to me and said, hey, do you mind if I come take pictures of you in this beautiful floral headdress? Use that picture to paint a giant mural. And I was like, absolutely yes. I definitely was not humble about it, or was like, no, not me or mine. I was like, absolutely. Because again, I know what that means to have a Black trans femme memorialized in this neighborhood that doesn't really have Black trans femmes in it and maybe should. And so now my face is a reminder of what this city represents. And I love that. And I should not be the last person of color, the last femme, the last trans and non-binary person to have a mural or to be memorialized in this city. I want to be the beginning of that movement, not the end. So that's a little bit about, and so me and that artist are actually the ones who are going to be talking at the exhibit on Friday. And opening the exhibit, and her artwork is, she painted a smaller portrait of that same mural that's going to be in the exhibit, along with a bunch of other artists, and the whole point of the exhibit is trying to raise resources and awareness for the Equal Rights Amendment to be ratified into the U.S. Constitution. Awesome. So, I love my community. We don't have the best legacy, but because of our past, we're that much more determined to make a brighter future.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth. And together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's fantastic. So when is it? It's getting revealed this week.
Yeah, on the 17th of February. Okay. And so, yeah, it's going to be, and then right after that, I'm doing a conference for the CAA to talk about how burlesque, the session I'm doing is Play to Escape the Hell Times. And that a lot of us can relate to that. It can feel like the hell times or the last few years. And so I get to do these two amazing things back to back. And I am the luckiest person in the world to be able to do this kind of work and to be recognized for my work, because so many people who look like me are never recognized for their work.
It's super cool. It's going to be a great Friday.
I'm excited.
This happens. That is like, really,
I want to see it. Yeah.
No, I'm like, okay, how can I get to Richmond?
Well, the exhibit's open until April 2nd too. So just saying, if you're in town, it's going to be up for a while. But yeah, the opening ceremony is on Friday.
That's awesome. Great. That's great.
So burlesque.
Yeah, burlesque.
I'm a fan, so I would love to hear a little bit about it all. So you said you did drag for a while.
I did.
Okay. I'm in Arizona. And so obviously the conversation around drag shows became quite a hot button issue for us the latest round of politics. But would love to hear how you got into drag and then how you transitioned to burlesque, because both are amazing.
Yeah. So I got into drag because I was a Drag Race baby. So when RuPaul came out with the show Drag Race, I watched from season one. I was a hardcore stan. I don't always love some of the stances that RuPaul takes. However, mm-hmm. I would say that RuPaul is a genius, is a media mogul, and really put a marginalized art form into the mainstream. And now it is appreciated by so many more people. It's gotten so big, so huge, and still a fan of anytime queer people are celebrating their art and creativity. And so I was getting into drag and I was like, oh, well, I love performing. Let me do this. And what I didn't realize is that drag was really, I didn't love performing in drag as much as I loved just presenting as a femme, which was very new for me. And that was my gateway to kind of gender, my gender awakening. And so one time, so I was doing drag and a burlesque performer, so somebody saw me perform and then their cousin was a burlesque performer and said, "Hey, I told my cousin about you." And that's the thing about Richmond. We're all, like, 2 degrees of separation, any one of us from the other. And they said, you know, they'd love to have you host one of their burlesque shows at the speakeasy. And I was like, say less. I heard the word speakeasy. I heard the word burlesque and hosting. So, which meant that I didn't have to come up with a number and perform. I could just be myself and present as femme, which was check, check, check for me. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And while I was there, I was enamored by the art form of burlesque. It is a traditionally effeminate art form that is, well, here in Richmond, is open to anyone. We actually have a few male identifying performers, Bert Schaefer, I'm sorry if I'm getting that wrong. You know, Mr. Blow Your Back Out. Sorry, you might have, this is kind of, burlesque, it's sexual, but it's not inherently sexual. It's more of like a wink and a nod and like cheekiness. But burlesque can be so, it can be satirical, it can be political, it can be, it's oftentimes hilarious and humorous. And so as I was watching this, all of the like dynamism and how every person brought their own kind of take to this art form, I was smitten. And so at that point I said, I met up with a legend in the burlesque scene, Lottie Ellington. And I saw her perform while I was in college and walked up to her and was like, I would love to take you to lunch and just ask you about burlesque. And she took me under her wing, introduced me to some people. I ended up doing my first number was a Spice Girls tribute where we did a couple of group numbers as the Spice Girls. We did a couple of solos and it was so fun, so amazing. And the thing that really sealed the deal is it was so healing for me as somebody who was discovering their body as a trans person and receiving a lot of like, not necessarily hate. There was some hate, but there's also just kind of like, well, why? Like, I don't know. And, you know, why would you want to do that? Da, da, da. And also a lot of people saying, well, you don't really look like a trans woman. So like, are you a trans woman? And, you know, again, that imposter syndrome set in. But the thing about burlesque is, as I was revealing more of my body to the audience, they were applauding more. And there is nothing like being trans and in a body that you feel is ostracized and having people applaud you for showing it and being aware of it and being shameless about it. And the other thing I love about burlesque is it is for all bodies. It is not for, you know, Dita Von Teese is, I think, what most people think of when they see mm-hmm. burlesque. And Dita does a very refined, Eurocentric type of burlesque. And that is absolutely great. There are so many other types of burlesque out there. And it's not just for these conventionally attractive bodies. They're for attractive bodies, no matter if they're conventional or not. They're for fat bodies, they're for slim bodies, they are for differently abled bodies, and Black bodies, white bodies, everything in between. And seeing people with every type of body type go up and be loved by the community was so healing. It's so beautiful. And shout out to AfroTees, my absolute favorite production in the entire world, and all of burlesque, who does an all POC tribute to burlesque, and they do a cookout in the summer, which is, that's just the theme, and then they typically do one in the winter. So I just went to one in January. Absolutely incredible. And if you haven't been to a burlesque show, go to one. Don't just look for the ones that look like the Dita Von Teese level. Go to your local burlesque performances and ask around if you don't know where that is. You will not be sorry. It's unlike anything else. And the community, you build a community with the audience as somebody in the audience, and you build community with the performers. It's beautiful, and I can't say enough good things about it.
Awesome. Very cool. Okay, so your mural, for those of you who are in Virginia, is on MacArthur Avenue in Richmond.
Yep, the yoga building.
Say that again.
It's in the building that it's on. It's on the side of is the True North Yoga building on MacArthur in the north side of Richmond.
Perfect. Awesome. So one of the things we like to do at the end of our episode is just what are one or two things. Jackie always does like eight, so you know, feel free.
I know it's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. What are some things that you want to make sure people hear, or you know, things that we want to make sure that they get across from this conversation?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to do eight things too, probably.
Okay.
Support the LGBT community right now, because we are under so much political duress. Just like you said, you're in Arizona, and there's in the South, I've heard things in Texas too. Luckily, I haven't seen this in Virginia yet, but there are people who are building these phone trees to show up and picket, drag queens reading to kids, and they're shutting down libraries who host these things. And people, the communities have, and some communities have funded libraries because their institutionalized funding is taken away, which I think is beautiful, but unnecessary. I think it's children. There's nothing inherently sexualized about drag. If anything, any drag queen will tell you, drag queens are much closer to fun clowns than you know, something that's inherently devious or sexual. And the thing, I think the perception around that is the fact that drag had to start in clubs because it was one of the few places that we could do drag without being arrested. It used to be illegal to dress in the opposite gender's clothing. So they came up in clubs. And you know, in clubs, sometimes seedy things happen. And some performers are hypersexualized, but I guarantee you the ones that are have no interest in reading to your children. The ones who, and they're colorful, bright, kids love drag. They're bigger, you know, they're huge personalities. They remind them of their favorite, you know, superhuman or otherworldly characters. And I think that there's so much to be gained in not creating that barrier. So support local drag, support local burlesque, support mutual aid in your local communities as well. Again, they're in a world where we think we're not helping unless we're giving $100 to someone across the world. You can give $10 or $20 to someone on your street and change their life. You can share resources. If you're in legal or HR, look into areas of your profession, of your industry that are about inclusion, diversity, and equity. And try to build as much knowledge as you can, or find people who can teach you, and do your work with an inclusive and equity lens. It's really important. We all have a stake in this work. Mm-hmm. I would say, remember that Black Lives Matter. We are still, as a Black community, let alone in a trans community, we're still suffering at the hands of institutionalized and state violence. And so figure out what you can do to support your communities that way. And go do some fun stuff that are, you know, go see a drag show, go to a burlesque show. Not every form of activism is storming the streets or inherently angry or unhappy. There are ways in which we get together just to be joyous that are also forms of activism or forms of community equity building. And if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me as a person. I'm happy just to kind of, you know, give what I can. And if I can't, then I'll either say that or I'll direct you somewhere that maybe can help you. So just don't be afraid, dive in wherever you can. We all have a job, and it's a good time. I promise you, you will not regret it.
Awesome. Jackie?
I think itself, what I want people to take away is like explore yourself. It's a version of self-care.
Absolutely.
take the time to get to know. Quit trying to put yourself into the binary, because you can't be your true self by trying to put yourself into these boxes. Mm-hmm. And to do what you can with what you have and the time that you have. Nothing is too small, because for some, it's a matter of life and death.
It oftentimes is a matter of life and death. And that's the thing. And no one deserves to die because they're being their authentic self.
That's right. That's right.
I'm going to kind of piggyback on what both of you said. I think, you know, right now there are, I don't even know how many bills and, you know, legal action being taken in different states across the U.S. To discriminate against the entire LGBTQ community, but specifically the transgender community. Go understand what those things are in your community. Go and actually look them up and give money where you can to folks that are fighting some of this completely ridiculous legislation. Yes, go to a drag show. The folks that are dressing in drag and going to libraries to read to children, I agree with you wholeheartedly. It is such a fun and funny and entertaining for the kids. And there is no sexual component to it in any way, shape, or form. And yes, there are drag shows that are not kid friendly. And that is okay too.
As a parent, as up so that your
yeah, and usually your child is asleep when those things are happening.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that's the other part too, is you'll find those opportunities where you can have them exposed to drag queens, because I think that it is exactly like you said, it is a costume, a show, and such an amazing, like, you both know this, like the makeup alone. I'm like, I have no idea how you do that. That is amazing. But I think those are some of the things that are just really, really important. And yes, it's a show up where you can to support these communities, and go to Richmond, Virginia and look at a very, very cool mural.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just a plug, if you do want to reach out to me, if you want to contact me, my email is aurorahiggs@gmail.com. My Instagram is aurorawhoishe. I put up a lot of, just kind of photos of myself, selfies, but also a lot of mutual aid campaigns. And so if you are interested in following me in my life, feel free to find me on those two channels.
Awesome. Perfect. Aurora, thank you so much for being here and chatting with us. We love having these conversations, because I think it also just the exposure to, and very, like, we talk about the fact, Jackie and I talk about the fact that we're just having conversations with folks. Yeah. And I think there still is this mystery or, you know, ignorance around, you know, what is it like to talk to someone who is trans, or what is it, you know, who is in this community and that kind of thing. And you know, these conversations are so critical that, one of my friends, Angela, she says, you know, we're just very boring. We're not as exciting as everyone thinks we are.
Right. No, we are not like an alien creature. Some of us are so boring. I'm not. I'm very simple, but I reserve the right to be boring. And I am a grandma on the, is this Victorian lace collar kind of should tell you as much. We are not, you know, we're people too. So,
yes,
you know, let us live.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. This is the Inclusive AF podcast. This is Katie Van Horn.
And this is Jackie Clayton.
Bye.
Welcome, change agents, to your go-to place for stories that ignite your spirit, fuel your purpose, and connect us all. We believe in the incredible power of the human spirit, its boundless resilience, and the inspiration it brings to our lives. On the Driving Change podcast, we'll journey together through the extraordinary yet very relatable experiences of some of the most amazing people on earth. Our mission? That through these stories, we might just spark change within you and awaken a newfound motivation to harness your unique gifts to make a real difference in the world. So get ready to be inspired and join us on this incredible adventure. You can find the Driving Change podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you love listening to your favorite podcasts.